I've spent a lot of time recently thinking about a man I don't know much about. I don't know what he looked like. I don't know how old he was. I don't know where he was born or where he died. What I do know is his name. Richard. He was enslaved, and he was on Last Island in 1856. Last Island, Île Dernière. Back then, they spoke French in southern Louisiana, and that island was about as far south as it got. Last Island was a resort, a place where everybody who was anybody went for the cool salt breeze. The wealthy of America's slaveocracy would go there in the summer to have balls, parade down the promenade, relax. But behind their leisure was a hand of slave power that ran everything. I know a little bit more about the man who owned Richard. Thomas Mill was a Frenchman. He ran a sugar plantation out in the bayou. Mill took his family to their mansion on Last Island that summer. On August 9th, a Saturday night, they danced in a grand ball in the local hotel. But on Sunday, they looked out into the waves and felt the bracing winds approach. A storm was coming. That night, the winds grew stronger. The scions of Last Island panicked and packed themselves into a hotel. But Richard was worried. He tried to convince the master and his family to leave their mansion and take shelter in a stable, but they refused. The storm's eye approached. Waves got higher and higher. The surge of water the storm pushed ahead of it raced to the island. It hit like a tidal wave. Through it all, Richard braved the storm in the stable. His only companion that night was an old horse. The next morning, the only building still standing on Last Island was that stable. Richard and the old horse had made it. Many other folks weren't so lucky. About half of the people known to be there died. Richard found his master's 18-year-old daughter bleeding from a head wound and delivered her to safety. She was the only member of her family on Last Island to survive. As far as we know, Richard was the only person they enslaved who survived. Everything we know about Richard comes from a newspaper interview with the daughter he saved. The story of Last Island became a sensation across America. It was sensational in part because of who died. In the 1850s, southern Louisiana had the highest concentration of millionaires in the country. The Last Island hurricane had killed a lot of them. The idea of doomed grand balls and final pageants of the plantation aristocracy was also tragic and romantic. But I don't really care about that part. I just can't stop thinking about Richard. The Last Island hurricane was a Category 4 storm when it hit. It's been called the first great storm in the recorded history of Louisiana. It seems like every generation has one. 1893, 1915, 1947, each with their stories and their myths. Each with their Richards. The last big storm in New Orleans was Hurricane Betsy, 1965. And then, for 40 years, it was quiet. From the Atlantic, I'm Van Newkirk, and this is Floodlines. Part 1, Antediluvian. The summer of 2005 was like any other summer. People all over the city of New Orleans were doing what they do. Working, going to church, sitting on porches. Kids were out of school and having fun. And maybe nobody was having more fun than Leanne Williams.
Oh my God. I was a daredevil. A tomboy.
Leanne was 14 that summer. She spent her days playing with her cousins on Dumaine Street in Treme, the black neighborhood known for jazz and second lines.
They'll let us run in the street and play freely. But every time a call come, I remember we'll say, "Car time, car time." That means get out the way, a car coming. You can't play football, freeze tag, nothing. You got to get out the way.
Second lines and parades were such a big part of life around Dumaine that it was how Leanne and her cousins played pretend.
We'll have the trumpet player, the trombone player, the snap drum player, the bass drum player. And the tuba players will have sticks blowing. And my cousin's friend, he'll have a big wheel on his neck, and he'll have it throw it over his shoulder because, you know, a tuba is heavy. So that was pretty heavy for him to carry at that age. And we'll sing and march on down the street.
Leanne was also playing basketball that summer. She was the only girl on the team, and she was known for her lockdown defense.
They used to be mad. Get it off the team. Make her go sit down. She all on me. I'm like, that's what you're supposed to do. Take the ball away from you. They used to be mad.
Leanne was a basketball fanatic. But those days, she had a little extra motivation.
I had this crush on this boy named Fonzo Jones. And Fonzo was the point guard. Lord, I had the biggest crush on him.
That summer, Fonzo asked her out. They were an item.
He'll walk me home every day. We'll cut through Dumaine Street, and we get to the Claiborne Bridge, and the Claiborne Bridge leads to my house. I stood on the corner in the front, and he would walk me home every day.
Leanne lived in the Lafitte Projects, just around the way from the Tremé Community Center. Her mom worked on Tulane's campus, and her stepdad was a star musician in a city full of star musicians. They had plans for Leanne. The last school year, she had worked hard to get good grades, and she had just gotten into a fancy high school. She was going to be starting in August.
My dad took me school shopping, and I had my Jordans that I wanted. I had my hair in some long braids. We call them booty braids in New Orleans because they're so long. I thought I was the stuff.
The first day of school was Thursday, August 25th, 2005.
Couldn't wait for my first day. I was up at 5 o'clock, clothes laid out, trying to close on the day before in the mirror, looking, trying to see how I looked for my first day of school. I was just so happy.
Around the time Leanne got up, the 11th named tropical storm of the season was heading toward the coast of Florida. It was small then, but strengthening.
I remember my science teacher, Mr. Smith, telling us to track the storm. So I only was able to track it that Thursday and Friday because I didn't go to school after that. We had to get prepared for Katrina.
News anchors and meteorologists first started calling the storm Katrina on August 24th, a Wednesday. That's when it gained the 39-mile-an-hour winds needed to become a tropical storm. It came up from the south and east of Florida.
You are looking at Tropical Storm Katrina, and residents in South Florida are keeping a very close eye on the system. It could become a hurricane before it moves in late tomorrow or early.
It became a weak hurricane for a couple hours. Then it made landfall just north of Miami.
The hurricane came ashore with winds of 80 miles an hour, barely.
It crossed over the southern tip of Florida Thursday night and Friday morning.
It's now a Category 2 hurricane making its way across the Gulf.
It weakened over land, but entered the warm Gulf of Mexico intact.
And Katrina is getting stronger.
The storm's gaining even more strength.
With winds of up to 115 miles per hour.
It was due to strengthen on Saturday.
New Orleans, you are in the very big realm of possibility.
This is the big one, as the mayor put it. We're showing you now pictures.
The big one always has been a Category 5 hurricane that would put so much water over the coast that it would overtop the levees.
That's Mark Schlefstein, an environmental reporter in New Orleans.
I'm known in the office as Darth Schlefstein.
Why is that?
Oh, because I'm always reporting on, you know, what kind of disaster can occur.
Mark was worried. And Mark is a guy who covered the worst disasters for years. He's not the type to get worried easy. He was worried because of a prediction he'd made 3 years before. In 2002, he and his reporting partner, John McQuaid, had written a series about the big one hitting New Orleans, following the same path as Katrina. The stuff they predicted was alarming. A hurricane would hit the city. It would send record-breaking storm surges through the lake and the river. Without wetlands to stop the surge, it would grow higher and higher. All of the drainage and shipping channels around New Orleans would funnel that surge directly into the center of the city. The levees would simply be too low to stop the water. Mark and John predicted a city uninhabitable for at least 4 months, with up to 100,000 people dead. But even their editors were kind of skeptical about the reporting.
One of my editors actually said, well, this is just more of Schlesstein's disaster porn. And I said, well, you know, like real pornography, disaster porn is in the eye of the beholder, and there's 100,000 people who live in New Orleans who don't know that there are no plans to get them out in advance of a major hurricane.
Did you ever feel like you were, I guess the phrase shouting into a hurricane is not a good one here, but...
a Cassandra? Yeah. I did.
When Mark first saw the projections for Katrina, all those visions of the city being destroyed came back to him. He was in touch with Max Mayfield, the director of the National Hurricane Center. Mark was trying to tell his editors how serious the storm was going to be, but it seemed like they just saw more of his disaster porn.
So it's 4 o'clock on Saturday in the newsroom, and I'm at my desk, and the editor and publisher are standing behind me while I am attempting to explain why it is important that we run a copy of a storm surge modeling map on the front page. And some of those same things were coming up. Well, you know, is this really going to happen? I mean, you know, you're talking about the death of this city, blah, 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 blah. And the phone rings. And I pick it up, and it's Max Mayfield. And before I had a chance to say anything, he says, Mark, how high is your building? What kind of winds can it withstand? And I said, Max, what are you telling me? He said, what do you think I'm telling you? This is the big one. It's coming right at you.
This is Jeffrey Goldberg. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. I want to tell you a little bit about our magazine. For 163 years, The Atlantic has been the magazine of the American idea and the American experiment. Our journalists have written about America's great successes, its devastating failures, and its unique challenges. Our journalism is rigorous, fair, comprehensive, and driven by deep moral urgency. I hope you see in Floodlines all of these characteristics. And I hope that you will want even more Atlantic journalism in your lives. You can gain unlimited access to all of The Atlantic's great stories by subscribing. Go to theatlantic.com/support us to learn more. That's theatlantic.com/support us. Thank you.
New Orleans was built by levees and pumps, by holding and moving water to create dry land. If you drive long enough in just about any direction, you'll wind up in water. There's Lake Pontchartrain to the north. The Mississippi River curves from west to east around the bottom of the city like a smile. The water is such a part of the geography of the city that people use it like directions. Lake bound, river bound, upriver, downriver. And just downriver from Treme is the 7th Ward. That's where Fred Johnson was that weekend. He was getting ready for a parade.
And I was oblivious because I was running around picking up different items and I was not in tune to the weather. And every time I'm in and out the car, I'm listening to music. I'm not listening to the news.
Fred's one of those Smokey Robinson types. Smooth, ageless, wears lots of gold bracelets and earrings, has no fear of the patterned shirt. Fred Johnson is a lot of things, but most of all, Fred Johnson is a 7th Ward booster.
You had the collectiveness of a village.
Once you get them started on the old days.
We had all African-American teachers. Barrooms and grocery stores on the corner. Schools was right across the street.
It'll just keep going.
They had authority and consent to bust my ass and send me home. We standing on the corner and we smoking a cigarette. And, you know, we just blowing smoke, talking crap. And I look up and I see Miss Melville. Oh, shit. I took off running.
Fred co-founded a group in the city called the Black Men of Labor, a social aid and pleasure club. They raise money for good causes, mentor black youth, and they throw parades like you wouldn't believe. Their second lines are famous.
So late that evening, when we said, okay, that's all we can do for the day, when we come out, the guy says, hey, man, we got to evacuate. I'm saying, what you talking about? They said, yeah, man, they got a storm coming, and they calling for an evacuation. And I'm like, oh, shit, I'm not evacuating. I'm tired. I'm not getting on the road.
Fred wasn't listening to the news, but the people who were listening had heard nothing but confusion. Mayor Ray Nagin dragged his feet on evacuation orders and then finally made the call just a day before the storm came. Authorities failed to get buses to people, leaving lots of poor people stranded. Nagin declared the Superdome the shelter of last resort. Hospitals and nursing homes couldn't get patients out. Even with that, about 80% of the population managed to evacuate, which has never happened before. But still, about 100,000 people were left in the city.
So what I did was I stayed. I had worked, I guess, like 12 hours. I was so tired, I was seeing double.
Alice Kraft Kearney was working as a nurse at Charity Hospital on Saturday. She worked the night shift and didn't get off until Sunday morning. Lots of hospital employees had already evacuated, so they were understaffed.
I was just literally exhausted because so many people had called off. They said, I'm not coming to work. I'm not coming to work. So, you know, so we had more patients. And I mean, I never stopped running.
Charity served lots of poor folks without insurance. Alice had worked there for almost 20 years.
I just fell in love with it because the people looked like me who I served. And they had so many needs.
Now, there are a lot of things that Alice will not say directly. But she has a tell when she wants to say something that might be a little controversial. She'll tell you what she will say.
Now, what I will say is, when I was there, my mission was to make sure they treated my people well. Okay? I made sure that when the doctors seemed like they were a little callous, I said, look, this person needs this, this, and this. And I was their advocate, but I had great nurses before me who taught me.
After her Saturday night shift, the idea of evacuating at the last minute just didn't look great.
And so as I was driving here, the lines to get out of the city were crazy. So I went to my brother's home in the lower ninth ward. His house was elevated. He has a 3-story historic home in the lower ninth ward. So that's where I went.
The lower ninth ward is on the east side of the Industrial Canal, separated from the main area of New Orleans. Way back in the day, the neighborhood was swampland. There's old stories of escaped enslaved folks hiding out there. But by the time Alice's folks were looking for a place, it was a thriving neighborhood.
The lower ninth ward was like, I guess you could say Mayberry for me.
Her mother, Miss Hattie, still owned the pink house where she'd raised Alice and her 6 siblings. Growing up, all of Alice's friends used to stop by for Miss Hattie's cooking.
They would come and they'd say, Miss Hattie, what you frying? And so she said, I'm just frying some cornbread. You want some? So they would have cornbread and syrup and you'd just see them lined up.
The pink house had flooded before, during Hurricane Betsy, back when Alice was a kid. Alice's own house was out in the east, which often flooded. So that Sunday before Katrina, her brother's 3-story house seemed like the safest place.
The highest part of New Orleans is near the river. My brother lives near the river. He lives in an area called Holy Cross. So he has some of the highest land, as far as elevation in the city.
One fascinating thing about New Orleans is that the Mississippi builds its own levees. All the dirt piles up beside the river over time. That means it's actually safest right beside the river, because much of the rest of town actually sits below the water. People call all that high ground the sliver by the river.
Sliver by the river. That is the region of the city that's 6 feet or more above sea level, at least 6 feet above sea level.
Sandy Rosenthal moved to New Orleans 40 years ago.
I'm originally from the Boston area of Massachusetts. I still know how to park the car.
Sandy married a local. They lived upriver from the French Quarter, in a neighborhood that's wealthier and whiter than the rest of the city. Uptown.
I taught fitness because I enjoyed it, not because I needed the money. I played in a lot of tennis. I was seeing girlfriends a lot for lunch. I would say that's the typical uptown housewife girl that I was.
In New Orleans, you're always dealing with nuisance floods. Water up to your car tires kind of stuff. But Sandy wasn't too worried about flooding uptown.
There had not been a major hurricane in 40 years. We knew we had levees. Most people paid absolutely no attention to them. If anything, the levees were hills that was sometimes fun to roll on. We just assumed they would work.
When Sandy and her family heard Katrina was coming, they moved all their stuff upstairs to the second floor of the house and joined the long line of cars driving north. The plan was to get out of the city for a little bit and wait in a hotel somewhere for it to blow over. It'd be like a vacation.
We didn't have any transportation, so my mom was pretty scared, but we didn't have a car or anything to leave, so, and she didn't want us to go to the Superdome that was out.
Leanne Williams and her family didn't really have a way out of the city, so they decided to do what they thought was the next best thing, take shelter in her mom's apartment in the Lafitte Projects.
We in the project, the bricks not gonna move. They're not moving for a hurricane, so they all came by us.
Sunday afternoon, Leanne and her cousin Arielle were making the most of their time before the storm started. They rode around the neighborhood on bikes and stopped by the wing spot on the corner.
They was giving out free chicken, just frying chicken and giving out free chicken. And we went got us some free chicken, my mom a free chicken and everything. I guess they were trying to get rid of the food, you know, before the power goes out. We rode up Dumaine, we rode up Ville, we rode up Treme, and the rain was coming down on us, and we getting soaking wet. We were laughing, having fun. Teenage girls having fun, riding the bikes.
United Radio Broadcasters of New Orleans, a service of WWLAM. Intercom.
While everyone in the city waited for Katrina to pass, a lot of them tuned into the local radio station, WWL.
Keep your radio locked for continuously updated official information. On the AM dial, the big 870 WWL.
If they were tuned in that weekend, they would have heard the voice of Garland Robinette. Garland had been on the air for decades in New Orleans, mostly as an anchor on TV news. He'd retired, though, years before. But that Saturday before Katrina hit, he was filling in for a sick friend. From the beginning, he had a bad feeling about the storm.
I came out of a coffee shop, and there was a big palm tree. And in the middle of it was green parrots. Somebody had let a pet out, and it propagated like there were hundreds of them. And every time he'd come out of the coffee shop, it'd be like you couldn't hear yourself think. I walked out. I looked up. No parrots. Walked to the end of the street, looked around. No dogs, no cats, no birds.
On the radio, he found that the callers were just as nervous as he was.
And people start calling in, you know. We're on the way out. Don't see any birds. Don't see anything.
On Sunday night, Katrina got closer and closer to New Orleans. Garland and his team were broadcasting from a high-rise building not too far from the Superdome.
I think we were on the eighth or ninth floor with a gigantic window behind me overlooking the Superdome.
Just around the corner at the Hyatt Hotel, Fred Johnson and a bunch of his friends had decided to wait out the storm, too. It's something people always did in the city when hurricanes came. If you couldn't get out, you went up.
So we end up, we're on some 10th, 12th floor, whatever the case is. They're having a hurricane party. I mean, they're drinking their asses off. I'm like, no, give me an hors d'oeuvres.
the rain picked up late Sunday and never stopped. And in those high-rise buildings in downtown New Orleans, the wind started getting dangerous.
The wind started hitting and it started howling a little bit.
That giant window behind Garland started rattling.
It sounded like... It exploded. And engineers came in, got me out real quick, took me down a hallway. The station on each side was just destroyed. Glass everywhere, furniture all, and they took me down to a closet. I broadcast all night from the closet.
About 10 o'clock that night, they made a call on the PA system because now they realized that the windows would not withstand the velocity of the wind. And if the wind pushed the window in, you could get sucked out. So they said, take your bedspread and bring your toiletries and come down to the third floor ballroom. So when I get to the third floor ballroom, there is people all over the place. So I made a pallet on the floor, and I had on a khaki shirt and a khaki pants and a pair of little summer shoes. And I think I had on a little khaki Kango cap, and I just pulled the cap over my eyes because the level of fear that was in the room, I was trying to not to visualize it.
I could just remember this loud whistling sound. Katrina had a peck on her, I'm telling you. She did.
Katrina moved in slowly. The rain and winds got stronger and stronger all night. Across the city, all the defiance in the face of the storm settled into a kind of tension. Leanne and her family kept an eye on the TV news, watching things go from bad to worse. Finally, there was one weatherman who broke.
He had fear in his face. You could tell he was scared. And he was like, may God be with you. And when he said that, the power went boom. It went out. That was the last thing of family. Any kind of communication, the outside, that was it.
ABC News. This is World News Tonight. Reporting from ABC News headquarters, Charles Gibson.
Good evening. Katrina was bad, very bad. But Katrina did jog slightly east just before hitting land, and that spared New Orleans, a city actually below sea level, the kind of direct hit that residents have worried about and feared for years. Still, the city.
Katrina, it turned out, wasn't the big one. At least not in New Orleans. Around 10 p.m. on Sunday night, forecasters knew the storm had weakened. It made a turn to the east. But as it hit the Gulf Coast, the hurricane did massive damage and caused hundreds of deaths in parts of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama.
So in the area around Gulfport and Biloxi, it is a very dire situation tonight.
Authorities are going to be in rescue mode long into this night. This is the worst storm to hit Mississippi in over 35 years.
ABC in New Orleans, though, compared to the doomsday scenario, it was a little less extreme. Houses were flooded. Roofs had been blown off. Windows were shattered. It was bad, but not apocalyptic bad. The people who evacuated could come back soon. And the people who stayed had hopes things would get right back to normal. Leanne and her cousin Ariel were in a quiet, pitch-black New Orleans for the first time in their lives. They went outside to take it all in.
I just couldn't believe how many stars was in the sky. And we just sit and talk about us and when we get back to school. We can't wait till this over with and they drain the water out the city. And I can't wait to go back to Tribune Center so Fonzo can walk me home. The city was black. No street lights, no nothing. You were able to see the sky. It was. It was beautiful.
Leanne couldn't have known it then, but the city was already on borrowed time. Levees across New Orleans had already been breached, and at that very moment, millions of gallons of water were pouring into the city. That water would not stop for days, until nearly the entire city had been filled. The country would watch while the city's people were betrayed. Everything was about to change. Because in New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina was not the disaster. The disaster was what happened after.